You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
You made very good time, Tim.
I came on my bike and I was wearing electrically heated pants.
What?
Innovation works in mysterious ways. Come on in, I'll tell you all about it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. OK. Oh, gosh, me. Right. Is everybody ready for some economics?
Yes.
Yes, excellent, good. I want to talk to you about innovation. And that means I need to talk to you about two men. It also means I need to talk to you about British cycling. It's been a pretty good year, right? Just to focus on the velodrome, the Olympic team. Did anybody keep track of how many gold medals we won? Yeah, a lot, yeah. Well, I like precision, that's right. Just to be a little more specific, the score was Team GB, 7 gold medals, the entire rest of the world, 3 gold medals. Well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good going. And I was thinking about this. I was watching this amazing performance, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could figure out what makes them tick, if we could figure out why they're so successful, and maybe bottle it and distribute it a little more widely. And now we know. Now we know what the secret is. It's not Chris Hoy's thighs, amazing as they are. Something else. The secret is a man called Matt Parker. And it was Matt Parker who came up with the idea of the hot pants. For he realised that athletes would warm up and then they'd sit on their bikes ready to go and their muscles would cool down. And what they needed was electrically heated pants to keep their muscles warm. And then just before they'd go, he'd rip the pants off and away they'd go. The hot pants. It was also Matt Parker who realised that if you rubbed a little alcohol on the wheels of the bike, you could clean dust off the tyres and then they would have a little bit more grip. And as you started out of the starting gates, you'd get going a little bit faster. Matt Parker also pointed out to the British Olympians the importance of good hand hygiene. Wash your hands really thoroughly, make sure you get the thumbs. Because the Olympic Games are full of people from all over the world, all kinds of foreign germs you've never been exposed to before. People get sick quite a lot, so wash your hands. And always, always travel with an orthopaedic pillow because you want a good night's sleep. You don't want to be waking up feeling a bit stiff if you're trying to race for gold in the velodrome. It was Matt Parker who realised that there was an hour between the sprint semifinals and the sprint finals. And he called it the golden hour. And he said, if we could somehow maximise our athletes' ability to recover in that hour, that could be a critical advantage. And if you go and look at the numbers, you find again and again and again the British athlete going faster in the final than in the semi-final, and again and again and again the foreign athlete going slower in the final. And Matt Parker's job title was Head of Marginal Improvements at British Cycling. And I love the idea of marginal improvements, marginal gains. The idea that you take a process, a complicated process, and you just break it down. And you look at every single part of it, and you ask yourself, could we make this just a little bit better? And I wish that governments, that corporations would just focus a bit more on these marginal improvements. Some do, of course. You know, web companies tend to constantly optimise their web pages. But why doesn't the government use marginal improvements in the school system, universities, in the National Health Service? It would be brilliant. We could really do with it. But although I love the idea of marginal improvements, I'm worried about something. I'm worried about the fact that not all innovations are marginal improvements. Penicillin wasn't. The Spitfire wasn't. The internet wasn't. Sometimes we make gigantic leaps, and they're very long shots. And it's not so easy to persuade somebody to fund those long shots. Let me give you an example. The example concerns a scientist called Mario Capecchi. 30 years ago, Mario Capecchi applied for funding to the National Institutes for Health, which is a wonderful organisation based in the United States. It's taxpayer-funded, and they do medical research. They fund a lot of vital, life-saving medical research. But they're kind of into the marginal improvements thing. And that's understandable. They're spending taxpayers' money. They don't want to fund failures. They want to fund innovations that are almost guaranteed to succeed. So show me the track record. Show me the previous publications. Show me something that will convince me that there will be a result here. There will be a publication. There will be something that we can call progress. And that wasn't what they got from Mario Capecchi. And he went to them in the early 1980s. He had this idea. He was going to take a gene in a mouse's DNA, and he was going to take out that gene. He was going to replace it with a different gene. Just a little thing. It's kind of like, you imagine walking into a medium-sized bookshop and opening one book and replacing one sentence on one page of one book, only you're doing the whole thing on a molecular level. But you're not going to do that with tweezers and a magnifying glass. It's hard. It's really hard in the early 1980s. And to the National Institutes for Health, they thought Mario Capecchi's idea wasn't just hard, it was impossible. It was science fiction. And they said to Capecchi, look, you're a great researcher, we're quite happy to give you funding, please go away and do something boring and forget about the mice. To understand what Mario did next, it's helpful to know a little bit about the man's history. Mario Capecchi was born in northern Italy, just before the war. And his earliest memory is of the Gestapo knocking on the door of his house and arresting his mother and taking her away to a concentration camp, probably Dachau. Capecchi's mother never married his father. He was a violent man, and she was a political dissident, and she knew that this would probably happen. So she had to make provision for Mario. He couldn't stay with his father. He couldn't stay in a house by himself. So she arranged for some local villagers in northern Italy to look after him. But after a year or so, something went wrong with that plan. And we don't know exactly what. But Mario, 4 and a half, ended up in the care, I use the word advisedly, in the care of his father. And he later said, nothing he went through was as painful as being treated violently by his own father. And after just a few weeks, Mario Capecchi ran away, and he wasn't even 5 years old. He spent the war in and out of street gangs, in and out of church hospitals, church orphanages, and by the end of the war, Mario was 8, and he was sick, really sick. He was staying in a hospital. He didn't have any clothes, because the hospital knew he'd try and run away if they gave him clothes. Just had a blanket. They'd give him some chicory coffee to drink and a bit of dried bread to eat. And he was living in conditions that a lot of Italian orphans were living in, and a lot of them died. Mario, of course, did not. On his 9th birthday, somebody turned up at the hospital to collect him. He didn't recognize her. And that was because after spending the entire war in Dachau, his mother had changed beyond recognition. She spent a year combing Italy, trying to find him. And she dressed him up in traditional Tyrolean costume. He still got the hat with a feather. And she took him to America, where she had relatives. So Mario spent over half his life feral. He doesn't speak any English. And the next thing you need to know is that he went to Harvard. He studied under James Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA. And James Watson's a pretty scary man. And Capecchi said to Watson, I want to be a molecular biologist. It's this brand new field studying DNA. I want to be a molecular biologist. Where should I study? And Watson looked at him like he was mad. He said, you should study here at Harvard. You'd be flipping crazy to study anywhere else. Except he didn't say flipping. And Mario did study under Watson for a couple of years. Watson later said that he achieved more in those 2 years than most scientists achieve in a lifetime. But then he left. And the reason he left is very interesting. He said Harvard had become a bastion of short-term intellectual gratification. Too many smart people trying to impress too many other smart people in a hurry. Too many marginal improvements. And Capecchi said, if you want to do great work, if you really want to innovate, if you really want to make a difference, you need more space than that. And he went to Utah, where they didn't even have a Department of Molecular Biology. He set one up. So a few years later, he bumps into this grant-making body from the National Institutes for Health who say, ooh, don't do that mouse thing. Very, very risky. Yeah, right. And Mario took the money. And he spent it exactly the way he wanted to spend it. And he knocked that gene out of the mouse genome. It's called the knockout mouse. He replaced it, and he laid the foundation stone for all gene therapy. He went back to the National Institutes for Health 3 years later, and they said, we're very glad you didn't follow our advice. And in 2007, Mario Capecchi shared the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Now, it's an inspiring story. I love stories about stubborn geniuses, but it makes me worry. And the reason I worry is because I would really like an innovation system that doesn't just support stubborn geniuses, but supports anxious, nervous, shy, risk-averse geniuses as well. Is that too much to ask? Maybe it is. Is there something we could do? And the answer is, yeah, there's something we can do. There are examples, but it's not easy. And the reason it's not easy is very simple. If you're a Matt Parker, and I stress again, this marginal improvement stuff, it's really important, it's really valuable. But if you're a Matt Parker, you come into the office every day with new data proving that things just got a little bit better. And you look brilliant. And if you're pursuing long shots, the thing about long shots is most of them don't come off. Most of them are failures. You come into the office every day and you look like a loser every single day until the day you make that breakthrough. Mario Capecchi made the breakthrough, but the truth is, sometimes the breakthrough never comes. You look like a loser all your life. You are a loser. And there's no way to tell the difference. But I have drawn comfort from one organization called the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Just like the NIH, it funds medical research. Unlike the NIH, it's interested in the long shots. It's happy to see failure. It wants to be convinced that if there is success, it's success that's going to make a difference. And when three economists studied the outputs of the NIH and the HHMI, they found that, sure, the NIH, marginal improvements, delivers success almost every time, and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute fails very often. But if you're interested in research that really makes a difference, that's in the top 1% most cited papers, you need to fund the long shots. You need to do things the way the Howard Hughes Medical Institute do. And we need both. It's just one of them's really sexy, and one of them isn't. But I am pleased to report the Howard Hughes Medical Institute are very proud of one of their new principal investigators. His name is Mario Capecchi. Thank you very much.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.